Thank you for the hospitality here at Perimeter. Thank you for inviting me to give this talk that doesn't have much to do with corners, even if actually I wish it had. And you'll see why. So what I'm talking about today is the computation of partition functions of Chern-Simons theories, mostly abelian, on Handel bodies. This is based on work that I did with my former student, Cedric Yu, and it's published over there. Let me see if the, what are the three things. So, and let's see how we go with this slide. Yes, okay. So, Chern-Simons theories are interesting because they are topological, but you can give them a dependence on metric data if you give, when you give appropriate boundary conditions on open manifolds, on manifolds with boundaries, better. So when you compute partition functions of Chern-Simons theories on manifolds with boundary, they are can be thought of as wave functions of the corresponding Hamiltonian theory. And for those wave functions, for in the case of abelian Chern-Simons theories, we actually have a very explicit basis that was computed in the 90s. So we have partition functions that are some wave functions, and we have a very explicit basis of the wave functions that span the entire Hilbert space that comes from canonical quantization of Chern-Simons on a Riemann surface. There is also an implicit basis of partition functions for abelian and non-abelian Chern-Simons that makes the connection with, well, there is a basis of wave functions that makes the connection with partition functions very clear. I will review that for the extent that is necessary. So in this talk, I will just do a change of basis. I will relate the basis of wave functions that compute the partition function on a Handel body. And to do that, I'll need two ingredients. I'll need radial quantization. I'll need an initial condition for radial quantization. And then I'll need also a useful identity that says that when you start with a wave function and you evolve with radial quantization, you will get a gauge invariant physical wave function. So let me go into the details of all this after finishing the review. First, I will describe the partition function without any insertion of operators, namely Wilson loops. Then I will talk about Wilson loops, and we'll see that we rediscover something that generalizes what is called the framing anomaly for Wilson loops. And then I'll say a few words about the partition function of non-abelian Chern-Simons theories on a torus Handel body. Unfortunately, we couldn't do anything more complicated than a Handel body in the non-abelian case. But for the torus, we'll also see that we can compute the partition function with a Wilson loop insertion. And in that case, there will be an interesting identity that we could only prove by brute force in one case, but should be valid in general, though we weren't able to prove it. So the abelian Chern-Simons bulk Lagrangian is as topological as it comes. Right? There is no dependence on the metric in this expression, where I use the form language as usual. A is an abelian connection on M. Indeed, it will be an abelian one form when we integrate. So the action is topological, but you can introduce a dependence on non-topological data by adding boundary terms when your manifold has a boundary. So in particular, you can introduce this boundary term where, and to write it, you need to define a complex structure on the boundary. You see, you need to define what is the coordinate z and z bar on the boundary of a manifold. Here I will take, for the rest of the talk, a Handel body. So the boundary of a Handel body is a Riemann surface sigma. Okay, so that's the way in which the complex structure is introduced. Of course, if you had two U1s, you could also introduce topological boundary conditions, but that would be really not what we are interested in. What I'm interested in trying to find this mix of topological and non-topological. And you had a question.
That's the other thing.
You almost killed him. So you only have in mind connected boundaries? Is that?
I only have a handle body with a connected boundary, yes.
Okay.
So the partition function is computed by a functional integral given here, where I have the bulk and the boundary, and k here will be an even integer to avoid any subtleties with anomalies. So this equation, actually this z, is also a wave function in holomorphic quantization. And it is gauge invariant under with the appropriate definition of gauge invariance, how you find what is the action of gauge transformation on z. Well, there are many ways. One shortcut is to notice that this object, the scalar product of two wave functions in holomorphic quantizations, with the same IB that appears here, right? This object should be gauge invariant. So that defines for us what is the gauge transformation. The gauge transformation just shifts the argument of the wave function by an abelian gauge transformation and also introduces this prefactor. Again, this U is leaves the scalar product invariant. Now, as I said, the partition function is also a wave function. For abelian Chern-Simons on a Riemann surface, we have an explicit basis of the Hilbert space of all the gauge invariant wave functions. That was given by Boss and Nair in 1990. There is a very explicit formula. In this formula, mu is a g-dimensional vector with integer components going from, say, 0 to k minus 1. So it's an element of z k to the power g. K is an even integer. And I have decomposed the boundary value of the anti-holomorphic component of the gauge field into an exact part and into a harmonic part, written in terms of the abelian differentials on the Riemann surface, on the holomorphic abelian differentials. Now, this f is a function that can be computed explicitly in terms of the determinant of the Laplacian on the Riemann surface minus the zero mode divided this object computed in terms of the period matrix omega. This ratio factorizes into the square of a holomorphic function times something else, and this something else is what is known as the Quinlan anomaly, and there is also an explicit formula not only for the Quinlan anomaly but for this S, whose second variation is the Quinlan anomaly, given, for instance, by Zograf and Tartajan. So this is, in principle, known. You can compute. Okay, so the question is very simple now. The question is, which linear combination of these wave functions is the partition function of the Handel body? We have them all, so we have just to find what is the combination, the linear combination. And actually, this question was answered in a different basis. It was answered by Witten in 1989 noticing that all the entire Hilbert space of gauge invariant wave functions, that for the our case of a compact gauge group is finite dimensional, is written in terms of partition functions on Handel bodies with insertions of Wilson loops. For the abelian case, you only need Wilson loops. For the non-abelian case, you need more complicated configurations. So you write the you can write the partition functions and you insert all possible Wilson loops around non-contractible loops, and you can also add this decoration. We will see later what that means. You can also add Wilson loops along homology cycles that are non-contractible on the surface, but contractible in the bulk. Okay, so if you do that, you generate a complete basis of wave functions, for our case, which is compact abelian Chern-Simons, by the state operator correspondence. Now, explicitly, this state operator correspondence simply says that, well, you want to compute a partition function in the Handel body, so you integrate with the bulk plus boundary action, and you insert all the possible Wilson loops along various cycles labeled here by C. Right? So here I have a product over the non-contractible cycles, for instance, but you can actually do it on generic cycles. The coefficients mu actually take value exactly in the same space as the coefficients that we saw in the formula given by Bose and Nair. Now, so the question is, how are these wave functions related to the explicit Bose and Nair basis? We have a basis of partition functions, right, which is also a basis of wave functions computing in a particular basis. And we have also an explicit one, the Bose-Nair basis, that is very special because Bose-Nair is holomorphic in the gauge connection, as any wave function should be in holomorphic quantization, but it is also holomorphic in the complex structure, and that's special. So the question was G or 2G. You can put 2G here, though the, as you will see, the part that really gives independent wave functions is only up to G. Indeed, we'll have a nice formula that explains what happens when you add Wilson loops along contractible cycles. In some sense, you know that should be a decoration, right? Should not give you an independent wave functions, but we'll see that explicitly in a short while. So how can we do this computation? Well, one way would be to decompose the Handel body into a sphere with holes and then handles. And then, so handles are cylinders. So ideally you could say, I have a sphere here. So I can compute the partition function on a sphere. We know what is that. We can compute the partition function of Chern-Simons on a cylinder that topologically is a sphere. And then we glue the top and the bottom of the sphere to some of the holes of my, top of the bottom of the cylinder, sorry, of the cylinder to this sphere, for instance, here and here, et cetera, and form a genus G surface. Now, we can do that. There is also an equivalent way of doing that, namely taking the Riemann surface with a given period matrix, and then deform the complex structure until the structure becomes singular, until one of the handles pinches, and then try to reduce the problem to computing the partition function on a handle body with lower, with less handles and lower genus. Now, in both cases, we encounter a problem. If we try to compute the partition function of Chern-Simons here and here, we miss something. We missed some degrees of freedom that were associated with the corners of this cylinder, for instance. The cylinder is topologically a sphere, but it has corners. And there are some extra degrees of freedom that we couldn't account correctly. So we run into a problem with corners. And when you run into problems with corners, you avoid them, right? So we just move to another way of doing the computation. And that was suggested by the state operator correspondence. So in the state operator correspondence, you start with some state in the bulk, and then you propagate by radial quantization. So we did the same. We foliated the Handel body as a Riemann surface times an interval. Notice, it's very important that this foliation is singular somewhere. Actually, part of the story will be how to treat the singularity. So we take a singular foliation of the handle body. We have a Riemann surface, and then we deinflate it until it becomes actually, say, a one-dimensional surface with intersection, right? And then we have to take care of what happens at the singular leaf of the foliation. Well, so ideally what we do is this. We start with this manifold, and then we start with some initial state at, say, the value zero for radial time. We propagate in time for an amount of Euclidean time r, and then we compute the overlap of this, the evolution of this initial state with a coherent state at the end of the evolution. So a state where that's an eigenstate of the anti-holomorphic component of the gauge field. Okay, so we need to compute this kernel between some initial state and the final state. So we need to find what is this psi zero and find what is the Hamiltonian H, right? To make sense of this formula. So let's start with the case with no Wilson loops. The foliation, as I said, degenerates at r equal to zero because the manifold is singular everywhere. There is nothing special in the axis of the cylinder. There is no singularity there. So this imposes a strong condition on the initial state. And to see what this condition is, it's useful to notice that, of course, when you have a handle body, you locally your space is like a solid cylinder. Now, on a solid cylinder, there is a cycle that is non-contractible on the boundary, right? But then can be contracted in the bulk. So there are some, indeed, half of the cycles of the Riemann surface, sigma of the boundary, are indeed contractible in the bulk. Okay. To see what this condition means, it's useful to introduce a quadratic differential, a quadratic meromorphic differential called the Strebel differential. So Strebel or Strebel-Jenkins, actually, is a quadratic meromorphic differential that's closed and whose horizontal trajectories cover a set of codimension zero. So almost all the surface can be covered by horizontal trajectories. What are horizontal trajectories? Here they are. So a trajectory is simply a curve on the Riemann surface. Right? Here I am defining quantities on a leaf, on a Riemann surface. You take a closed path on the Riemann surface. If h times the zdt square is, say, real or and positive, that's what we call a horizontal trajectory. So this kind of trajectories can foliate the entire, well, can cover almost all the Riemann surface. Okay. Now, the Strebel differential defines a flat metric and a two-valued vector field. So you define a metric, and that's well-defined everywhere. So this is a metric where this the curvature of the Riemann surface is concentrated at some points. So it's flat in most of the space, and then there are some the singularities where all the curvature is concentrated. You can also define a vector field, but notice that you take a square root. So this is only defined modulo sine. And once you have a vector field, you can also define a trajectory, right? So you can just integrate the flow of this vector field. Now, the important thing is that what we'll need is to define trajectories that are closed loops that then will become used for something else. Well, the point is that here, to define a trajectory, you need V modulo a function, a real function. So this equation is well defined even if V has some, is two valued. And another way of saying this is that actually the components of the vector field may have branch cuts, but they cancel in the ratio V star over V, which is actually the only thing that will appear in our formulas. By the way, the fact that V is double valued is precisely why you introduce a quadratic differential, right? Because that doesn't have the sign ambiguity. So, okay, the horizontal trajectory of the Strebel differential can be chosen to be homologous to the those homology cycles of the Riemann surface that Fourier's D manifold, which are contractible in M, right? So you can choose the horizontal trajectory to be deformable to these cycles that I drew here, the ones that can be contracted inside the bulk. And these are all things that were proven by, well, I mean, this is because simply you can't define your horizontal trajectory to be what you call, I don't know, the alpha cycle in an alpha beta basis of 1-4 of one cycles. So you can choose this to be homologous, right? In the same homology classes, this trivial differential, good. And now, let's notice that the Handel body is not singular at the origin, at the initial Riemann surface, at the initial leaf, right? So defoliation degenerates, but the Handel body is non-singular. And in particular, this means that the component of the gauge potential along the cycle that contracts to zero should vanish identically on the initial state. Right? So this is really the, so this is the, if you have a cylinder, that would be the angular component of the gauge potential. And that should be zero, not zero modulo something, zero, zero. Now, this equation is very nice because we know it's actually a first order functional differential equation that involves AZ bar and its conjugate variable, which is a functional derivative. So it can be solved explicitly in terms of a squeeze state. So you can find explicitly what is this psi in a holomorphic basis, right, in a coherent state basis, and it is this nice squeeze state that, as you see, and as promised, depends only on the ratio V bar over V, so it's well defined when you change the sign of the vector field. Okay, so this state is good, simple, but it does not obey the Gauss law. But actually, its radial evolution does, thanks to an identity that I won't prove for you, I will just state it, namely, take the initial state, evolve for any time you want, right? And then what you will, this evolution is equivalent to taking the initial state and then summing over all the gauge transformations, large and small, connected to the identity, not connected to the identity, right? For, so you take this psi, do a little bit of radial evolution, and that projects over a physical state. Notice there is no dependence on R. Again, that's a crucial equation, but I mean, it has been proven several times over, so I will not derive it. So, but this tells us that the radial evolution projects over gauge invariant states, so we can use our non-gauge invariant state as a seed that generates the wave function that corresponds to the vacuum partition function. Because remember, we want a wave function that describes a non-singular manifold, a manifold that doesn't have a singularity at radius equal to zero. Now, so what can we do at this point? Well, at this point, we can just take the initial state, do a gauge transformation of the initial state, and compute the overlap with the coherent state. All of these are known explicitly because we know psi zero, it's just a squeeze state. We know how the gauge transformation acts on coherent states. You remember we derived it some slides ago. And then here you have your formula. Right. Here, lambda is the U1 transformations, denotes the U1 transformations connected to the identity, and theta denotes large gauge transformations because here we are in U1, in compact U1, not in a non-compact translation group. Again, notice that the offending V appears only through the ratio. Now, the non-trivial part of this Gaussian integral, this is a Gaussian integral in lambda. So we know how to do it, right? The non-trivial part of the Gaussian integral is actually the equation for the saddle point. Because the equation for the saddle point, when you vary in lambda, seems to depend on auxiliary data. Namely, it depends on the metric that you give on the manifold, the one that we computed in terms of Strebel differentials, and it depends on the choice of the vector v. All of that was not present in the original partition function. So if it doesn't cancel, it means that something very wrong has happened. So we have to compute the saddle point, and then the quadratic fluctuations are actually the easy part. The saddle point equation is given here. I mean, it's a standard linear equation. To solve it, we can decompose the boundary gauge field. You remember, you fix the anti-holomorphic component of the gauge field on the boundary of your handle body, so you fix A bar. You can decompose this fixed A bar into a fixed exact part and a fixed harmonic part. Theta bar, of course, expands as a linear combination of the anti-holomorphic one forms, I mean, the anti-holomorphic abelian differentials. So so the equation now can be recast with some simple manipulations in this form. You have a derivative along this vector, so precisely along the horizontal cycle, right, of the exact part of the gauge transformation, the small gauge transformation, and the exact part of the gauge field, plus some harmonic stuff. And this plus that should be a holomorphic function. Now, the interesting thing is that when you integrate over a contractible cycle, first of all, this part drops out because it's exact. And second, this part should also drop out because it's because the cycle is contractible. So that gives actually an equation that allows you to express the derivative of the small gauge transformation at the saddle point and the exact part of the boundary gauge field, the derivative along the vector v, in terms of the harmonic parts. Now, notice that here in the harmonic part, there is this object, which is pretty obvious. But this theta twiddle is not the complex conjugate of theta. It's just same coefficients as for the theta bar, but now multiplied by the holomorphic abelian differential, not the anti-holomorphic. I mean, you can prove this simply by taking this expression, plugging it back, and showing that this indeed is a holomorphic function. You can also be pedantic and expand everything into a basis of real cycles, alpha and beta, identify the alpha cycles with the contractible ones, and then verify this equation just by brute force. Okay, so we have an equation for the saddle point. Remember, we are integrating in lambda, so the equation is an equation for lambda. All the rest is fixed by the boundary data. Now, if you substitute this equation into the action, you find a very pleasant surprise. Namely, all the terms that contain the harmonic part of the gauge connection depend neither on the metric G nor on V. So there is a universal part that depends on the on some extra data, on some metric data, but that's the universal part of the partition function, the one that really is the same for all configurations. It's this fluff. Then the interesting part of the wave function is this one, because it's the harmonic part, and it's the one that could take k times g different values for Bose and Nair, and here we find a particular value. So the partition function in the absence of Wilson loops is a particular Bose-Nair wave function, is the Bose-Nair wave function with mu equal to zero. Remember, the Bose-Nair had zero here at the bottom, and instead a non-zero number proportional to mu here at the top. And so this is the answer. This is the answer for the partition function with no Wilson loops. But now we have become, now we know how to proceed. And then the next obvious thing is to ask, what about insertions of Wilson loops? How do we compute the partition function in that case using the same method? Well, here we have to do an extra step. We have to regularize a bit the Wilson loop. The Wilson loop is pretty singular as an object. Yeah, it describes a current of a point-like particle that goes around a loop in some Euclidean time, right, along a loop C. So instead of that, we spread out the charge all over the Riemann surface. So we take this Wilson loop. We can think of this Wilson loop as actually lying on one of the leaves of the foliation. And then we spread it out on the entire leaf. So we define a 2D current with holomorphic components W and W bar, and we write the coupling of the abelian current to the gauge field in the usual manner. So we now we take what was an infinite thin wire and we open it up and we spread it out. Now, when we spread it out, we have to remember that the initial Wilson loop was gauge invariant under all gauge transformations, both large and small. If we want the currents to obey the same, well, first of all, the currents have to carry the total. I mean, when you integrate over a cross section, they should carry the right charge, right? That's obvious. But they should also be invariant under both large and, gauge, and small gauge transformations, the ones connected to the identity and the ones that are not connected to the identity. And that gives us this constraint on the harmonic part of the current. So the harmonic part of the current actually is not arbitrary. It of course, it expands in terms of anti-holomorphic abelian differentials. But it expands with this particular combination where mu and n are integer-valued vectors, g-dimensional vectors. Okay.
There's one question for you.
Massimo, sorry, can I ask you one question?
Yep.
I'm not sure I get what you mean by spreading out a Wilson loop. So what is sigma? So you're integrating
sigma
over
is
sigma.
is the leaf of my manifold. So you have a manifold, you do a foliation, and each leaf is a Riemann surface sigma. Then there will be one singular leaf, right? And
right.
And on this, you take this Wilson loop that is just a Wilson loop inside the handle body. Well, you think of this Wilson loop as sitting on a particular fixed leaf. And then instead of writing a current for a point-like particle, you write a current for a distribution of charges that spreads all over sigma. Sorry? Yeah. No, not necessarily. Actually, I just spread it out over the entire... Oh, yes, I can repeat the question. So I do not take a tubular neighborhood. That I'm actually spreading this. I'm more general than that and just spreading it out over the entire Riemann surface, over an entire leaf of the foliation. So the only thing that I ask is that the total current carried by this... The total charge that passes through a cross-section is the same as the original one. Because if I chose a tubular neighborhood or a ribbon, right, then I wouldn't be able to write a holomorphic function, for instance. So you see, this is a harmonic part, right? So.
And sorry, the fact that you can do this, that gives you the same results is because on the background on which you're putting a Wilson loop, you add contractibility, right? So you can contract, so you can move it around. Is that so?
Well, let's see. This Wilson loop is general, and actually, we'll see what this mu and n mean, because this has something to do with the question of whether the loop is contractible or not. Indeed, that's now. This thing now is a nice object, and we can compute actually what is the action of this W on the gauge invariant projection of the initial wave function. Since W is gauge invariant, you can commute it with the projector and let it act on the initial state. And that's nice because W is just the exponential of an object that's linear in A and A bar in the gauge potential. Psi is a squeezed state, so the action of W on psi is very simple. It gives you the initial squeezed state times this exponential of an object that is at most linear in AZ bar. So this is a squeezed translated state, right? Squeezed coherent. Right? Now, if you insert this initial state into the integral over gauge orbits to get the partition function with Wilson loops, you actually go through the same steps that we did before that I don't want to repeat, and you'll get a formula that's very similar to the previous one with two differences. The wave function now is different, And notice that here we can get any of the, we can get all the wave functions of Bose and Nair. Remember, they were labeled by mu, right? Mu is a vector with each entry. It's a g-dimensional vector with entries that are 0 through k minus 1. And this is a theta function with characteristics on the Riemann surface, of course. Right? But then what happened to n? Remember that there were these two numbers in the definition of the harmonic part of the current? Well, it only appears through a phase. Now, since you have a phase, you may say, who cares? That's a matter of normalization. Let's throw it away. But it, actually, it would be a pity because it has a nice interpretation. And to see this interpretation, let's write the Wilson loop corresponding to the generic vector W as a product of the Wilson loop for a vector W sub mu that has only this harmonic part, the one that contains mu only, and then W sigma nu that has only this harmonic part. And then you have whatever exact part you want. So if you write the W's in this way, right, the Wilson loop factorizes into the product of Wilson loop number one, mu Wilson loop, Wilson loop n Wilson loop, the second one, times precisely this phase over here, as you can see just by doing commutations of a and a bar of the two variables that appear in the Wilson loop. Now, a little bit of work actually can convince us that this W of sigma mu is the blow up of a Wilson loop along a non-contractible cycle, along a cycle that is homologous to the beta in a real basis. I mean, the cycles that go around the whole of the Meyer-Riemann surface. While W of sigma n is the blow up of a Wilson loop along the contractible cycle, the alpha cycles that then become contractible in the bulk. So now when, now you remember that we acted with W on the initial state psi zero. Well, if you write this W as the product of a loop along non-contractible cycles times loop along contractible cycles times this phase, well, this W actually does not do anything to the initial state. It's contractible, right? So contracts to zero because of the definition of the initial state. Remember, in initial state, the component of the gauge field precisely along a contractible loop vanished. So you end up with the W of a Wilson loop that is only defined along the non-contractible cycles times this phase. And that's the origin of the phase. That's the only sign of the decoration. You remember when I wrote when I drew the Riemann surface, I had Wilson loops along non-contractible cycles, and then there were these loops going around them. Well, the loops going around them, indeed, give only a phase. They are only a decoration, and that's the only effect of those loops. And also, when this number n is a multiple of mu, remember, mu is an integer too, then the phase is actually well known, it's the framing anomaly. Because when you take, if you take a Wilson loop and you do a framing of the Wilson loop, so instead of a loop, you take a ribbon, right, where you have many, many of them, one next to the other, this is something that you need if you do a perturbative computation, right? It's an alternative way of regulating the Wilson loop compared to ours. If you do that and you just do a twist, right, that will also will be decomposed into a Wilson loop that goes along the non-contractible cycle and then a certain number of contractible Wilson loops. So it's kind of amusing to see that here we have a generalization of a something that is well known in the theory of Chern-Simons and the theory of Wilson loop observables in Chern-Simons. This is all that I want to say about abelian Chern-Simons. Now, if you talk about non-abelian Chern-Simons on a torus, then here we couldn't do much, really. I mean, we could only treat the torus, and here is where it would be great to have a good way of treating actually the extra degrees of freedom that come from the boundary of either cylinders and spheres with holes or the contributions that come from singular Riemann surfaces where one of the handles degenerates, where one of the handles pinches. So far, though, the only thing that we could do is to consider a torus, namely, you take a cylinder and then you identify the top and bottom of the cylinder with a twist in the angular coordinate phi. Now, we choose as initial boundary condition at the axis of the cylinder a gauge field that's purely harmonic. We don't care about the exact part. That, again, is fluff. And that's equal to this quantity, 2 pi mu over k. K is the same integer that appears in the action. And mu is a vector in the Cartan subalgebra, but that sits in the Weyl alcove. So it's defined in terms of the weight lattice divided by the semi-direct product of the Weyl group times k times the root lattice. So this is what is called the Weyl alcove or the undilated Weyl alcove, because in the theory of Chern-Simons, sometimes it's convenient to define a bigger Weyl alcove, not here. Now, as a final boundary condition, so at the boundary, we choose a purely harmonic field also, where U is just a generic element of the Cartan subalgebra. We know that the other part, the exact part, can be obtained from the harmonic one by just doing a gauge transformation. So we know how gauge transformations act on the wave function. We concentrate on the non-trivial part that is here. And again, we use the same trick as before, because now we have to compute a transition amplitude between an initial state at, say, radius equal to zero on the axis of the cylinder, that in which the angular component of the gauge potential is equal precisely to this 2 pi mu over k, and the final component in which the anti-holomorphic component of the gauge field is equal to this, right? Just this is the statement that we chose, a given initial value, that was an initial value for the angular component of the gauge field, and the final value, that is a final value for the anti-holomorphic component in holomorphic quantization. So you have to compute exactly the same thing as before. And now this formula actually explains a bit why this time evolution, radial time evolution, projects over gauge invariant states. When you integrate over the radial component of the gauge field, you get from the Chern-Simons action, you get a nice delta function that says that your integral over the AZ and AZ bar actually reduces, localizes on flat configurations, on flat gauge fields. Since the Fs are flat, you have this delta that says that FZZ bar is equal to zero, this the A's on the leaf can be written as a gauge transformation of a flat connection. And the flat connection, in the case of the torus, is very simple. It's just can be reduced to be a constant connection in the Cartan subalgebra. When you go above the torus, when sigma is not a torus, then things become much more complicated. Now, the also nice thing of this expression is that now if you take this decomposition of A, remember, A is flat, I mean, the curvature is zero, you plug it in back here, you get that the integral is, in reality, the partition function of a Vesumino model. The integral was given, computed a long time ago, and it's a nice function written in terms of the Weyl-Katz character for the for a representation of the Katz-Modi algebra with group that is the same, of course, as the Chern-Simons. So we have a very explicit formula here. And now the last thing that I want to say, I don't know how much time I have, but... So that will not take long. So what is the partition function with no Wilson loop insertions? It's the one where mu is equal to zero. How can you how can you insert Wilson loops? Well, let's take a Wilson loop that runs vertically on the cylinder, right? So if I have, you remember that I decompose the gauge field in terms, let me see, maybe I can go down, no. How do you go back with this? Okay. I decompose the gauge field in terms of this G and A. Now, there are two components of A, radial and along the vertical of the cylinder. Let's call it T, the vertical direction. A phi and A T are actually canonically conjugate variables. And the Wilson loop is along T. So in the end, it actually reduces to this. Reduces to this integral. You have the Wilson loop. You can make it act on the initial state because it's gauge invariant, and then you evolve in radial time. The Wilson loop is, of course, the integral along T of the gauge field. But since the gauge field is flat, the Wilson loop reduces to the trace over a representation with weight highest weight mu of the exponent of A sub T of the harmonic part of the gauge field, the constant gauge field along T. This is canonically conjugate to A phi, so when you act on mu with this exponent, you get a bunch of different values. So you don't get just a single mu, you get a bunch of values, and you get this formula. So you get that this kernel, which is the partition function with Wilson loop insertions, is a universal factor times a sum of Weilkatz characters indexed by this nu, where nu takes values in the weight system of the representation with maximal weight mu. So here we have the partition functions with Wilson loops, right? Seems the end of the story. It's almost the end of the story, except that we had another formula. You remember, we had a formula in which we fixed A phi to be precisely equal to this 2 pi mu over k. Right? On the other hand, the Gauss law tells us that when we have a Wilson loop in the representation k, that's the same thing as putting a source with charge mu. And therefore, you have this equation that tells us that A phi is equal to pi mu over k. So now you would say, the partition function is the Weilkatz character for mu, this chi mu, not a sum over different weights. So we have two formulas for the same object. And for them to agree, we need actually an identity among Weilkatz characters that reduces to an identity among Weil characters, just the Weil characters for the group. And the identity is this. So you have chi mu, and then you sum over the weights in a representation with weight mu, and you get that this sum should be equal to chi mu. So you have this formula. We didn't find it anywhere. We proved it by brute force for SU2, but it should be true in general, except that we have not seen it proven anywhere. Okay, so I am done now, so let me summarize what we did. The path integral of Abelian Chern-Simons theories on handle bodies can be computed explicitly by radial quantization. Radial evolution from an initial state projects over gauge invariant wave functions, and the initial wave function is fixed by requiring that the gauge field, the gauge potential, along contractible holonomy cycles is determined by the Wilson loop. So in particular, is zero if there is no Wilson loop inside the three-dimensional manifold. The partition function of non-Abelian Chern-Simons theories on torus handle bodies can be computed by methods similar to those used in the Abelian case, by radial quantization. But for non-Abelian Chern-Simons on torus handle bodies, we found that the validity of the radial quantization method requires a curious identity among Weil character that we could prove only for SU2, and because of our ignorance, we couldn't find in the literature. So that's all. Thank you.
Any further questions? There's someone doing the talk. Oh, Anna.
So in the non-Abelian formulation, when you get two different methods, that is valid for arbitrary, compactly group, compact.
So in the Abelian quantization, again, the point was to find a good parametrization of the moduli space of flat connections. I mean, that's really the thing that it makes this approach difficult. Because when your Riemann surface has genus larger than one, this moduli space can become a bit tricky even for SU2. Again, our original idea was different. Our original idea was to say that you start with a handle body. The handle body has a boundary that depends on some complex structure. Say you saw it in the abelian case. The complex structure appears through the period matrix. Now, if you start to play around with the period matrix, there is a point where a handle pinches. But when a handle pinches, say your handle body could become, for instance, a handle body of genus G minus one with an insert with two points, two special points on it. Now, if you knew what was the partition function for that particular lower dimensional handle body, then you could use the fact that the wave function, hence the partition function, is holomorphic in omega, and it obeys a differential equation in omega. So you could start with this initial data and move it to any value of the period matrix. But again, the point was exactly in understanding this factorization. The other approach, it's the one that I drew in one of the slides, is to write a handle body by gluing together, say, pans or n-hold spheres and handles. Again, that requires to know, requires to understand better what's the Chern-Simons theory on a manifold where the boundaries themselves have some special corners.
Yeah, so, I was mainly asking, so it's possible that this, your conjectured identity can be modified for higher ranks?
You mean the conjecture on the wild characters?
This wild character identities.
But which conjecture? The one on the wild characters or the conjecture on...
That identity, like your conjecture is, as far as I understand, it holds for arbitrary, like...
Well,
higher rank groups.
I think, based on the fact that the conjecture works for abelian Chern-Simons and also for non-abelian for the torus, I would think that once we understand properly how to describe the wave functions on a Riemann surface, how we find the right basis in a sense, right, or the right moduli space of flat connections, we may use exactly the same technique. Again, this is something, I mean, we know the the moduli space of flat connections in some cases for some groups, but and there are works that exist in the past, for instance, done by Gavetsky, but we couldn't actually put the things together. But I don't think that the radial quantization in itself will fail.
Okay, any further questions? If not, I think it's time for a coffee break, and I want to thank our speaker again, especially for the last minute change in schedule. We're very grateful for that. So let's give another round of applause. Thank you.